This is Kim Eagle. I'm the editor of ACC.org, and I'm delighted to give you today a podcast between Salim Virani and I looking at the new cholesterol guidelines. And we're live from the American Heart Association meeting in Chicago. Salim, welcome.
Thanks for the invitation.
The new cholesterol guidelines were a huge part of this meeting, and some really interesting facets come out of these guidelines that are so important for our clinicians. Let's start with primary prevention. The guidelines now give us four categories of risk. Is that right? Tell us
Correct.
How do we calculate those and what they are.
Right. So for primary prevention, so what we're saying is that these are patients who don't have established cardiovascular disease, these are patients who don't have diabetes, and these are patients who don't have primary elevation of LDL cholesterol above 190. So once they don't fall into these categories, then they fall into the actual primary prevention group. And exactly as you said, that in these patients, the guidelines would recommend first that we calculate a 10-year risk of having hard ASCVD events. Those would include fatal or non-fatal myocardial infarction, coronary heart disease death, as well as fatal or non-fatal stroke. So once that 10-year risk is calculated, we can pretty much have four categories of patients. Those who are low risk, those would be patients whose 10-year risk is less than 5%, 5 to 7.5%, which is a new category, we're calling them borderline risk, 7.5 to 20% risk, which is the real intermediate risk, and 20% or higher, which is the high risk group. Now, obviously, if you're low, you're low. Even doing a lot of further imaging or any other test will probably not move you in the category where you will derive a benefit from statin therapy. So those patients, really, lifestyle is the cornerstone of therapy for all of them, but for less than 5%, that becomes even more important. More than 20%, again, they are such high risk that you don't want to hold therapy, and the guidelines would recommend that those patients should be treated with preferably high-intensity statin therapy, even in primary prevention.
And the target is a 50% reduction?
50% in LDL cholesterol reduction, exactly.
Okay.
And then in those who are borderline, we'll talk about them in a second, but the real intermediate one, 7.5 to 20%, obviously this is the range where if the provider and patient should have a very good risk discussion as to what the patient really wants. This is obviously a category where we know from clinical trials that patients do derive benefit from statin therapy. As low as even 5% 10-year risk, they derive benefit from statin therapy. So this is really based on a discussion between the provider and the patient. There's also this category of risk enhancers. So if patients have them, I think we should lean more and more towards treating them early. And this is really another new aspect of this guideline, this concept of risk enhancers, and those all make intuitively sense. Those include family history of premature ASCVD. So if somebody's 10-year risk is 8%, but there's family history, we may want to start treating them sooner rather than later. So that would be one. If you have LDL cholesterol elevation in 160 to 190 range, we know their lifetime risk is very high. The 10-year risk may be only 8%, 9%, but lifetime, there's a very high risk of them having
right.
a heart attack or stroke.
Okay.
For females, especially, this guideline points out that if there is any history of premature menopause or if there was history of pregnancy-induced hypertension or preeclampsia, we know that those women are at higher risk of having cardiovascular events over the next 20, 30 years. So these guidelines are now saying that, well, get that history from women as well, which is really an enhancement. And then there are some ethnic groups that are identified as risk enhancers. So South Asian ethnicity classically has been associated with really a higher risk of having ASCVD events. So if one has those risk enhancers, if Lp(a) is measured, that's high. If ApoB is measured, that's high. Metabolic syndrome is present. If those are present, then that intermediate risk group, after having that risk discussion, one should probably lean towards starting therapy early or at least having that discussion with the patient. Now, the guideline writers understand that there is obviously a lot of reclassification that can happen within this category as well, and patients may have there could be some patients who are hesitant to start therapy because it's a lifelong therapy to be on statin.
Right.
So in those cases, if after doing a 10-year risk, doing a risk discussion, taking these risk enhancers into account, if there is uncertainty in risk, then a coronary calcium score can be used as a tiebreaker. So coronary calcium score is not a screening test. It's actually more of a decision support kind of a test whereby you do 10-year risk calculation, discuss with the patient, bring risk enhancers into account, and if after that there is any doubt in the mind of the clinician or the patient about therapy, then a calcium score can be done.
And I really like that. It's sort of a Bayesian approach where you get that prior probability and then that calcium score. The other thing it does is I find my patients who have that calcium score in front of them when it's high, suddenly they say, wait a minute, I've got coronary plaques in my heart, and I know you've been talking about this therapy for a while, but this brings it home to me, and maybe I should start. Exactly. So what about diabetics? Are diabetics, do we just treat them with statins? Is that what this guideline says?
Yeah, and then that stays fairly similar to the 2013 guideline, that if they're diabetics between the ages of 40 to 75, we should just treat them with moderate intensity statin therapy. On the other hand, if they have some risk factors, and then those are very intuitive again, longer duration of diabetes for a type 2 diabetic, 10 years of diabetes duration for a type 1, 20 years or more, having end organ damage, albuminuria, nephropathy, retinopathy, low ABI, all those things, if any of those are present, then the guidelines would tell us that treat them with high intensity statin therapy because definitely there's more benefit
to that. So you're talking about sort of a risk enhancer within the class of diabetics
as
right?
well.
So let's shift gears to secondary prevention. I think the guidelines also have been revamped in this regard. Tell us a little about those recommendations.
Right. So definitely this guideline has that change, which is different from our 2013 guideline, where all secondary ASCVD prevention patients were really lumped into one category.
Right.
But we've known for a very long time, and then every clinician who is seeing a secondary prevention patient makes that calculation in their head, that not all secondary prevention patients are created equal. Some are very high risk, and some are stable ASCVD patient. A patient who had a stent done 10 years ago and since then has been doing fine is probably not a very high-risk patient. On the other hand, a patient who just had an MI or an ACS event, got stented and still smoking, has poorly controlled diabetes, is probably very high risk. So what this guideline does is that it divides up those patients with ASCVD into two categories. One that's very high risk, and what that we're saying, not very high risk, or one could say stable ASCVD patients. So in stable ASCVD patients, statin therapy remains the cornerstone along with lifestyle. Whereas the very high risk ASCVD group is the one where clinicians should think about bringing in non-statin therapies, because these are the patients, we know that from trials of ezetimibe therapy as well as PCSK9 inhibitors, that when patients have those risk factors, they derive the most benefit from the addition of non-statin. So that's why we have this group of very high-risk ASCVD patients now in the guideline.
And what is the target LDL? When would you add a drug to statin therapy?
And that's, again, another thing that's described in the guideline now, whereby we're talking about the concept of threshold. A threshold is something that we're saying is not an automatic trigger, but it's something where clinician and patient should, again, engage in a risk discussion, even for secondary prevention, to consider addition of a non-statin. And that threshold is 70 milligrams per deciliter of LDL cholesterol for ezetimibe. And once statin and ezetimibe are both initiated and patient is showing good adherence to both, if LDL cholesterol levels remain above 70 or non-HDL cholesterol levels remain above 100, then one could initiate a PCSK9 inhibitor, taking into account the value consideration. And that's, again, a class 2A recommendation. So it's not a must, but it's something that can be considered.
Got it. We've had a lot of uncertainty with statin trials in treating the elderly, say, over the age of 75. How does this guideline help us in that regard?
So there are specific recommendations made for older adults. So some of the major points are that we know now from, you know, Jupiter trial, which was a primary prevention trial, as well as HOPE-3, had a fair number of adults who were above the age of 70, and some were above the age of 75 as well. If you look at combined meta-analysis of those trials, there's actually the older adults also derive a benefit. And now that our population is aging, we actually need to treat them to prevent both MI and especially stroke in older adults to prevent disability. So what these guidelines are doing is they're giving more tools to the clinicians that engage in a discussion. If you have a patient above the age of 75 who is actually doing very well but has a 10-year risk that's high, which probably would be high because of the risk calculation and the age being the biggest
right.
determinant, then think about starting statin therapy in those patients to reduce their future risk of ASCVD events, both MI and stroke. So that option is there. The other option is that if patient has multiple competing illnesses, then clinicians could back off on the statin therapy as well. And then the last thing about older adults is, again, this concept of using coronary calcium score for the risk stratification. It's been shown in older adults as well. So if age is the only thing that's driving that risk score, patient is not sure about taking a statin, calcium score could be used to further risk stratify older adults as well.
Excellent. I think the guideline is much clearer in this regard. I guess the last group I'd ask you about is the young person with familial hyperlipidemia. Kids that are in adolescence and young adults, when should we think about statin therapy in that group of people?
So, because exactly as we discussed that, you know, it increases your lifetime risk if you have high levels of LDL cholesterol, and there's some data now coming out that 20, 30 years down the line, it increases your risk of cardiovascular mortality as well. So for patients who definitely have FH that's diagnosed with LDL cholesterol above 160, one could think of starting statin therapy early. The guideline is saying, you know, 10 years, and in some cases even up to 8 years of age you could start, because we have safety data on statins. And then if there are definitely LDL cholesterol levels above 190, then after 3 to 6 months of lifestyle, if they remain elevated, then clinicians should very seriously consider starting statin therapy early now that we have long-term safety data on statins.
Outstanding. You know, this guideline, I think, is a huge step forward. The ability to calculate risk, to individualize therapy. And I got to congratulate you and all the members of this committee. It's a superb, superb document. And for our listening audience, we have the key points from the guideline on the website. We also have perspectives from additional experts. And I want to thank our learning audience for listening today to Dr. Salim Virani and an update of the cholesterol guidelines. You can find us online or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Eagle.